Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who I have come to regard as one of the real heroes of the war for the free world for his service in the uniform of the United States Navy as an intelligence officer for over 30 years is our first guest. His name is Captain James Fennell. In his last duty station in uniform, he was the chief of intelligence for the Pacific Fleet. He is an extraordinary analyst, observer, and commentator on what the Chinese Communist Party is up to, both militarily and geostrategically. And we're always honored to have him with us to talk a bit about that, especially at a moment when it certainly seems as though the Chinese Party and its military, the People's Liberation Army, are increasingly intent on conquering Taiwan with military force. Captain Fennell, it's good to have you back, sir. Thank you for your service to our country, including that you're rendering these days at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. It's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be back with you.
Let me ask you about your sort of assessment as a guy who has spent a lot of time in the intelligence business and evaluating various probabilities. How would you assess the danger at the moment that the Chinese Communist Party will move militarily in the foreseeable future, perhaps very near term, against the island of Taiwan?
Frank, I think we're really at a very dangerous point in this situation because the escalation by the Chinese Communist Party through the use of the PLA air forces, both air force and naval air forces, into the Taiwan Air Defense Identification Zone has just dramatically increased. We've seen 149 combat aircraft over a three-day period this weekend, this long weekend for China. And it represents, just a fraction of the air power that they have. And it's a dramatic increase in what has been an increasing presence and probing over the last two or three years, where we had, have maybe 7 or 8 or 10 aircraft at a time, and then it wouldn't happen for another month or something. And now we're seeing, in just the space of 3 days, 150 aircraft, essentially, along with naval ships and other things and submarines that are out and about and operating. And the Chinese have, the rhetoric is increasing, and their statements that, if the Taiwans continue to resist, continue to act up and act like they're a separate nation, that China will start flying aircraft over Taiwan. So I think we're at a point now where if the Chinese, at some point start flying aircraft directly over Taiwan, there's a great likelihood that the Taiwan military may try to take a shot at one of them. And you wouldn't complain if they did. I mean, it's their airspace, and if an enemy air force was to fly over your land, I mean, you couldn't just sit there and take it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a nation, and the next step would be occupation.
So talk to us about the preparedness of the Chinese People's Liberation Army to engage in such provocative behavior. Obviously, they can overfly the island if they choose to do so, but in terms of taking it to that next step of occupation, if there is resistance mounted by the Taiwanese with or without our help, how successful would you anticipate such an invasion by the Chinese likely to be?
I think the Chinese, the PLA has, they have mass on their side. They have a strategic rocket force. They have a larger air force. They have a lot more missiles. And they have a strategic support force, cyber activity. And then a naval force that's much, much larger, dramatically larger than the Taiwan, small Taiwan Navy. So in all categories, the PLA has a larger force. They have to go quite a ways, 100 miles, 90 to 100 miles, which is much larger, longer than what we saw, you know, with the Normandy invasion from World War II. But they have a strategy and a plan to implement that. And what Taiwan has is they have some defensive capabilities, but they have lots of, there's a lot of criticism of Taiwan in terms of the readiness of their reserves. The reserve force is not as long and as strong as it should be. The training of their soldiers, there's some concern about the motivation of the younger generations in Taiwan that may not be up to the snuff. And so from my perspective, the United States needs to be assisting, along with Japan, I think, to help Taiwan to be able to defend itself. Because if Taiwan falls, then Japan will be next. And then as a function of all of that, the United States would be driven out of the Pacific. And people may say, so what? Who cares? Well, when a significant portion of your economy is wrapped up in trading in Asia, and you no longer can control the access to markets and the freedom of navigation of your commercial ships, and they're left up to the whims of Xi Jinping, it's going to have an impact. We're already seeing impacts now in the global supply chain just from the implementation of Chinese Communist Party restrictions and procedures surrounding the virus. What we're seeing today with all these ships standing off Los Angeles at San Pedro and Long Beach and on the East Coast, and in China, by the way, that's all a result of China's Communist Party, policies towards treating the COVID. Do we think that's going to change if the Chinese have control of the maritime domain of the Western Pacific and Indian Oceans? I don't think so.
Yeah, to the contrary, it seems as though it would be intensified, especially if it is in furtherance of the bid for global domination that they certainly have made clear is their purpose. We'll be talking more about that with Michelle Bachmann shortly, Jim. But let me turn to your particular area of expertise. Given the order of battle that the Chinese PLA, Navy, Air Force, Army, sea lift, amphibious lift, missile forces, and so on represent at the moment, Jim, what is the relative state of the U.S. forces in the region? Are they capable, if push comes to shove, of contending with these various capabilities, particularly the synergy between them, the various elements of the Chinese military at the moment?
Well, we have a robust force. We have a four-deployed aircraft carrier, the Ronald Reagan. We have the 7th Air Force in Japan, the 5th Air Force in Korea. We have Marines, the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force. So we have a force structure. It's relatively unchanged for the last 30-plus years, but it is a potent force. And right now we have the USS Ronald Reagan Carrier Strike Group, the Carl Vinson Carrier Strike Group. We also have the British Queen Elizabeth Carrier Strike Group and the Japanese amphibious carrier Issei, all operating in the Philippine Sea in a combined exercise. And that's good. That's a good force posture right at this moment. But when the Queen Elizabeth goes back to England and when the Carl Vinson goes back to the U.S. West Coast, it's still going to leave a smaller force there. And oh, by the way, we know that the Chinese rocket forces have actually planned and targeted Japanese bases where U.S. ships are home ported and Japanese ships are home ported. So, we don't want to be precipitous in starting a conflict in terms of military presence, but we need to increase the presence, and it needs to be combined with a statement to China, which is to say, your unprecedented, violations of Taiwan airspace with military aircraft is unacceptable, and as such, we're going to, reassess or essentially say that the three communiques that we've agreed with you way back are no longer are valid because you violated those three communiques, and we are now going to start recognizing Taiwan. And if you increase your activity against Taiwan, then we will do more, China. So we have to, there has to be something that's tangible to them to know that their behavior is causing them to lose what they mostly want, which is to control Taiwan.
Right. Let's hold that thought, Jim. Ask you to go back over that three communiques business. How did we get to this point? Just a quick history course, if you would. There was a time, of course, when we did not recognize Communist China, power on the mainland of China. We recognized as the only legitimate government of China that on the island of Taiwan. A lot of diplomacy, a lot of votes at the United Nations and the like that has brought us to the present pass. But who were the prime movers behind those changes? And to what extent have they contributed to a prospect, a decided prospect now of war over Taiwan?
Right, Frank. Yeah. So back in 1971, you know, Richard Nixon was president and he sent his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, on a secret visit to China, the People's Republic of China, which we did not formally recognize. We had, to that point, had recognized the Republic of China that was on Taiwan, led by the Kuomintang and Chiang Kai-shek. And Kissinger came back and said, we have a chance to open up relations with the People's Republic of China if we switch recognition from the Republic of China to the People's Republic of China. And that will then allow America to have leverage over the Soviet Union, which was the great concern at that time period. And it took another 6-8 years until Jimmy Carter came in, and he was the president that formally oversaw the switch in United States official recognition from Taiwan, the Republic of China, over to the People's Republic of China. And Kissinger was involved with all of that. And so since 1979 until today, we've been living under this notion of one country, two systems, that we had an agreement that were signed in a number of communiques between Washington and Beijing that basically said one country, two systems. And it was predicated on this notion of engagement. Mike Pompeo last year called it blind engagement. I've called it unconstrained and unaccountable engagement. But we have had a policy of engagement with the PRC. And it's really a policy of appeasement. And we have appeased them and their desires, allowing them into the World Trade Organization, allowing them to be a currency in a basket of reserve currencies in the IMF. And we've allowed them and funded the growth of the PLA over the last 30 years. And now they're using the military that we helped them buy and build to threaten Taiwan with invasion and annihilation of 23 million people. Somewhere along the line, we had never drawn a line in the sand and said, that's it, China. You violated your commitments under the three communiques that you would not change the status quo in the cross-strait relationship. You have violated that, and we no longer are bound to your of that agreement. You have disregarded the agreement. So now it's time for us to defend the free people of Taiwan. And we haven't done that.
Yeah, this is hugely important, Jim. And if you were still in the business of advising commanders of the Pacific Fleet, what sorts of steps do you think would be advisable to essentially defend those people in Taiwan?
Well, I would most definitely not have given away Bagram Air Base, but that's another story. What we could do right now is I would make sure that the Chinese understood that the United States has ballistic missile submarines that are alive and well and operating in the Pacific and within weapons range of Beijing. And so I would make that abundantly clear through a physical demonstration, which we never, ever do. But I think in this case, showing a ballistic missile submarine sitting on the surface of the sea in a location that puts it where its missiles could strike Beijing would probably be the first thing I would do. And then I would start a much closer and tighter relationship with Taiwan and Japan in terms of rotational operations off the east coast of Taiwan, and not make it every once a year, but I would make it routinely once a month and increase our flying activity, escorting Taiwan fighters. You know, China in 2014, I believe, set up an air defense identification zone in the East China Sea. It was ridiculous, and the world laughed at him. It's a ridiculous zone because it's not in accordance with why people declare air defense identification zones. But it's still a zone that legally China declared. Well, Taiwan's Air Force could fly into that just by taking off and flying into the East China Sea. They should do that, and they should have U.S. and Japanese escorts, and there should be publicity about that Taiwan is doing the same thing to China as that China's doing to them, and that the United States and Japan, Washington and Tokyo, should say, and we are doing this to defend Taiwan and China. If you escalate this more, we will go further.
Should the next step be in the Taiwan Strait?
I think, we have not put an aircraft carrier through the Taiwan Strait since 2007. So it's been 14, 15 years. We need to send an aircraft carrier right now before things get much tenser as another indicator to China how serious we are. I'm always a little bit leery of putting a high-value asset like that in such a precarious position, but I do not believe that China today would attack an American aircraft carrier today. And so we should take advantage of that and send that through with a statement saying we are doing this to show to the People's Republic of China that you do not own that international waterway, and also that we are demonstrating our resolve to support Taiwan, and we're only doing this because of your bad behavior, China. Stop your bad behavior, and we won't sail through the Taiwan Strait.
I'm not sure I would make that commitment, because I think it is international waters, and we ought to preserve that option. But the point is taken, Jim. We need to demonstrate in tangible ways our commitment to the free people of Taiwan. And it does seem to me that we're at a moment where it's on the line, and what we need is a more permanent presence in those waters, not just an ephemeral one passing through. But all of these are issues that need to be teased out, and I hope that with your counsel, our government is going to be doing it right quick, because I think this does have the potential to slide very, very rapidly into, uncharted waters, as I think you would say in the Navy, and dangerous ones at that. Jim Fennell, again, we thank you for your service to our country, both that in uniform over many, many years, and that you are rendering these days. We're appreciative of your time and your efforts, especially as a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China. Thank you for all of that. I know you'll keep up the great work, and we'll look forward to talking with you again soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest, a dear friend, a much admired comrade in arms, a freedom fighter during her time in the United States Congress from 2006 to 2012, and now as a driving force behind, the effort to inculcate in the new generation the values that she has epitomized and that she knows are essential to the future of our country. Her name is Michelle Bachmann, a former member of Congress from Minnesota these days, the Dean of the Robertson School of Government at Regent University. She is the author of Care of Conviction, My Story, and we're always delighted to have her with us. Welcome back, Congresswoman.
It's always great to be with you, Frank. Thank you for letting me be on your important program.
Well, the pleasure is certainly mine. So many things I want to talk with you about. Let's move quickly through as many of them as we can. You recently convened a very important commemoration of 9/11, and the 20th anniversary sort of brought forward, I think, for many of us, both memories of what happened on that terrible day and lessons, I'm sorry to say, largely unlearned. Tell us about what your team pulled together at Regent University, and both how people can find it and what you think the most important takeaways were.
Thank you, Frank. I invite people to join us at Regent, regent.edu/911, regent.edu/911. We held an eight-hour conference examining the 20 years that have lapsed since September 11th, 2001, and the most tragic attack that America experienced since Pearl Harbor. As many Americans know, over 3,000 innocent Americans were randomly killed by jihadists on that day, both at the economic epicenter in New York City and at the Pentagon, the military epicenter of the United States. It was a direct attack on American power. Since those years, Frank, you and I have worked together for 20 years examining the motives of the jihadist terrorists and what they're doing today. That's what we did, especially in light of the collapse of Afghanistan. The war on September 11th began with America entering into Afghanistan. Why? Because in the caves of Afghanistan is where the attack on September 11th originated. That's why we were there. We examined with many highly placed individuals, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, reviewing the evidence, including yourself, Frank. You were also a part of this important anniversary conference. Why did we do it? Because there was an incredible anti-American attitude going on in our country, whether it's through critical race theory or Black Lives Matter and Antifa attacking our cities, or the canceling of 4th of July celebrations. We held this 20th anniversary because we wanted to make sure America didn't forget. We did this from an academic perspective, but also a practical perspective, so that people, and especially young people who weren't born or couldn't remember what happened on September 11th, wouldn't forget. And this is archived. People can see this. It is first class. And I encourage everyone to watch at regent.edu/911.
Wow. I was very proud to participate in a small way in it, and I thank you for doing it, because your clarity, both in Congress and since, Michelle Bachmann, about the nature of the enemy we confronted from that day certainly to this, and for the foreseeable future, I'm afraid, as jihadist in character, is something that, as you know, we were sort of told wasn't the case. That it was, it's violent extremism. It has nothing to do with the fundamentals of Islam, notably Sharia, and the holy war that it commands its adherents to follow. Fortunately, all Muslims don't do that, but authoritative Islam does require it. And I just appreciate so much that you have clarity, as I say, about this global Islamic movement and the danger that it represents to us, especially now, having sustained this defeat at Joe Biden's hands in Afghanistan, and the emboldening that it has given all of those jihadis worldwide, and not least the insinuation into our own country, almost certainly of some number of them in this unvetted immigrant population that's been brought in.
Frank, I'm happy you brought this up, because I believe, without a doubt, we are on the cusp of experiencing the worst jihadist attacks that we have seen in 20 years. I believe that we're about to see that happen and transpire in the United States. Why? Because of what you just said, Frank. Because of the way the United States pulled out of Afghanistan, a signal was unmistakably sounded like a trumpet across the Islamic world that they have conquered the United States. That's what happened. It wasn't the collapse of Afghanistan. It was the collapse of the United States of America. Our global military superpower status collapsed on the mountains and on the plains of Afghanistan. We are now seen as a defeated pup, defeated by the Taliban, the very ones who were on the ground 20 years ago planning our demise. Now, those same individuals, we literally packed on U.S. military cargo planes and shipped them back to the United States, because we have no idea who these individuals are. We have no idea who's coming across America's southern border, even today as we're talking. Literally millions of unvetted individuals are streaming into the United States to get on our welfare state, to commit fraud. There will be murders. There will be rapes. There will be every terrible felony committed in Allah's name to bring about the collapse of the United States. That's how bad this is. The enemy The Taliban is in charge today of Afghanistan, including those that are listed in the FBI Most Wanted, who have a $10,000 or $10 million price on their head. And now the Biden administration wants to ship your listeners' tax dollars to these same terrorists so we can prop them up. And the people that just 6 weeks ago we were trying to defeat on the battlefield, now the Biden administration wants to rebrand them into a normal, sane government where we give them foreign aid. That's how bizarre the Biden administration is and how they completely misunderstand the enemy.
Yeah. And if all of that were not bad enough, it certainly is. You have on top of it the fact that the Biden team has compounded the kind of damage that it did in this regard when it was doing business as the Obama-Biden team and gave, $150 billion to the Iranian jihadis by leaving something on the order, and the exact number is a little unclear, but the number's as high as $89 billion worth of weaponry in the hands of the Taliban to boot. It's just hard to imagine that this could possibly not conduce to vastly greater dangers abroad, yes, at the hands of the jihadis, but also here at home. And this brings me to one other really important topic. Michelle, I know that you're thinking about, you were a former member of the Intelligence Committee when you were in the House of Representatives. You were very focused on the then great and emerging even greater danger from the Chinese Communist Party. One of the knock-on effects of this Afghan defeat at Joe Biden's hands again is that the Chinese Communist Party seems also to be emboldened by what's happened and is making very little effort to conceal its determination to proceed aggressively against Taiwan. We've had a conversation with our previous guest, Captain Jim Fennell, about what that might look like, whether it actually will translate into war. What are your thoughts and what should we be doing to try to prevent?
Frank, just as we see a complete green light with a go signal for the jihadists across the world, it's also a green light and a go signal for the Chinese communists who are seeking to establish global hegemony, global dominance across the world. They've come in to Afghanistan. There were reports just in the last few days that the lights went back on in Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. The Chinese landed planes at Bagram. So essentially what Joe Biden did is, as you stated, the most advanced, sophisticated, expensive weaponry in the world was left for the use, not of the Taliban, but of the Chinese. The Taliban aren't equipped to even know how to use the $90 billion worth of equipment that Joe Biden left on the battlefield. They're so backward that they aren't even making their payments for electricity. The reports that are coming out of Afghanistan is that electricity may be cut off because the Taliban isn't even paying their bills to the Asian electric suppliers. But the Chinese are very sophisticated, very knowledgeable, very intelligent. They know what to do with this weaponry. So essentially, China has come in and taken over one of the most strategic staging grounds against their adversaries, the Russians, against their adversaries, the United States, against their adversaries, establishing themselves in the Middle East in a way they could have only dreamed of before to establish their base of the Silk Road. So therefore, because they are strengthened in Afghanistan, now they can project power against the Taiwanese, as you so clearly stated, Frank. Well over 90 Chinese aircraft in a day flew into the Taiwanese airspace. They may not even have to land a plane. They may, by force and intimidation, let the signal be known to the world and also to the Taiwanese, we're in charge here, and you bow to us. So not only may a shot not be fired against Taiwan to get them to submit to the control of the Chinese, they may not even have to land a plane, because it's evident and clear to the world that the United States of America under Joe Biden is no longer the economic superpower of the world. The United States has demonstrated we are neither the military superpower of the world. There isn't one day, Frank, that you and I and your listeners haven't woke up where we didn't realize that we were living in the nation that was the economic and global superpower of the world. That can no longer be stated. This is, people need to understand what I just said. The United States of America, in my opinion, is no longer the economic and military global superpower of the world. The result of that is the most unglamorous, essentially terrifying transfer of global power in the world, because it isn't Britain transferring the baton of global power to America. It is America dropping the baton of global leadership and China taking it up. And under China, we see how they treat their own citizens in a surveillance state, in a communist gulag for their own citizens. That is China's plan for all of the world and global dominance. That is the plan of the jihadists in Islamic dominance. So we have two very unique totalitarian mindsets, a green and red alliance, green Islamic, red communist, coming together for the purpose of global dominance. And then, of course, they'll fight each other. But the United States will be chewed up by these two empires. And it's all because Joe Biden was anti-American in his view of dealing with Afghanistan and his view of dealing with the economy. These are extremely serious times, as your intelligent audience understands. It isn't inevitable. We can always pray. We can always speak out. We can always use our voices. So it isn't desperate in that way. However, elections have consequences, and it is my opinion this election was stolen by the progressives who came in and took this election. And the one who is in office now is seeking to collapse our economy with their not $3.5 trillion deal. It's an excess of $6 trillion. We could work for the rest of our lives. Our children could work for the rest of their lives. Our grandchildren could work for the rest of their lives. There still wouldn't be enough money to pay off the debt just from this excess that Joe Biden wants to bring about. That's how desperate our economic situation is, Frank.
Yeah, well, that's such a compelling and I think accurate indictment of what has happened to our country under this president. There are so many things to be said about it. I basically would just leave you and our audience with this thought that this is not an accident, comrade. This is not a function of incompetence. This is a wrecking operation. And whether it's Afghanistan, whether it's our domestic economy, whether it's our election arrangements, it is all under assault by people who really want to affect what, you know, Barack Obama famously called the fundamental transformation of America. But let me just ask in the remaining 2 minutes or so we have with you, Michelle Bachmann, drill down on that point about the absolute necessity of election integrity. You did in the penultimate of these fabulous hours and hours and hours of conferencing a really important assessment of what happened in the 2020 election and how vital it is that we not allow the same kinds of fraud and manipulation of the votes and mail-in ballots and all the rest of it to be made permanent as a feature of every election across this country, which is the agenda of the Democratic Party in the Congress at the moment. Where does that stand, and how high are the stakes if we allow them to get away with that?
Frank, the number one bill that the Democrats want passed in this election term is H.R. 1, S.1, and it is the permanent legalization of voter fraud. You heard me correctly. The Democrats want to legalize voter fraud. There were 57 different voter fraud tricks that they used in this last election. Provable. Again, go to regent.edu/ election integrity. Go to regent.edu/911 for our conference on the 20-year anniversary of 911, but go to regent.edu/election integrity, and you will see all the proof you need to know that this election was stolen. regent.edu/election integrity. The reason why, Frank, they're so desperate to pass this legalization of voter fraud is because the Democrats know they have a wildly unpopular agenda with the American people. The American people have seen, as you aptly stated, a wrecking ball taken by the Democrats to our economy, to our liberties, to our freedoms, and to our foreign policy. So the American people have every intention of throwing the bums out in the next election. But the Democrats want to stop that because they want to legalize all of their 57 different voter fraud tricks. In fact, it's probably far in excess of that amount. That's what this is about. That's why they want to pass the reconciliation bill, which is a financial bill, because that's the only way they can attach their voter fraud legalization to that bill in order to make that the law of the land. So just realize, if you get behind the Democrats and their economic bill that they want to pass, what you're getting behind is the legalization of voter fraud, because this is a Trojan horse, this financial bill, in order to pass the legalization of voter fraud. That's the true intention of the Democrat Party.
Yeah, I'm a little unclear where that stands legislatively. I think the parliamentarian in the Senate may have said they can't use that particular vehicle, but you're absolutely right.
No,
unfortunately, they're going to use whatever they can. Am I wrong about that?
The Senate parliamentarian has ruled twice that the Democrats can't include amnesty for illegal aliens. Remember that they have an open southern border because this is the voter registration drive for the Democrat Party. These are the most selfish political monsters we have ever seen in our history. And so what they want to do is they at this point, the parliamentarian has not ruled that they can't attach the legalization of voter fraud to the reconciliation bill. The parliamentarian has ruled they cannot attach amnesty to that bill.
Another form of voter fraud, to be sure, if all of those folks wind up voting in future elections without being citizens. Michelle Bachmann, thank you for clarifying that. And this is a subject that we will return to with you, I hope, in the near future. Next up, we'll speak with Ben Weingarten about all of this and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is always a delight to be able to say we are joined by Ben Weingarten. He is a senior contributor at The Federalist, a terrific online resource, a columnist at Newsweek, senior fellow of the London Center for Policy Research, and a fellow also of the Claremont Institute. He's the author of American Ingrate, a book about Ilhan Omar and the progressives taken over of the Democratic Party. Ben Weingarten, it's great to have you with us. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Frank, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for that kind introduction.
You're welcome. When we last talked, I promised that we were going to visit with you about something you've written very powerfully about, namely the phenomenon of woke capital. I want you to both, you know, sort of define the term as you see fit, but also describe specifically what you've called its deathly addiction to China and the sort of policy of engagement. We've talked with some of our previous guests today about it, but I'm interested in your take on the role that big business is playing, and Wall Street in particular, in the United States, promoting this very dangerous agenda towards China, it seems to me.
Sure. Well, the many decades-long policy of engaging China was primarily focused on economic relations. And I've argued, and I haven't quite put it like this, but I've argued that the leading edge of China's influence operation in America and beyond is economic engagement. It is a way to create a relationship of sort of mutually assured destruction, a bear hug of sorts, where because our economy has become inextricably intertwined or close to it with the economy of communist China, that prevents America from doing what's necessary to defend its interests, defend its sovereignty, and of course, defend the national security of the American people. The greatest foreign agents in effect for the Chinese Communist Party in America are those in the business community, in the financial community, running the largest companies, managing either the most money or massive multi-billion dollar, many billion dollar enterprises who all want to continue what they think is going to be a gravy train relationship with China, but which in fact has not proven to be so beneficial when you consider hundreds of billions of dollars in intellectual property theft on a yearly basis, it seems, according to government reporting on it. And of course, the fact that we have underwritten and provided the Chinese Communist Party with the technology to build it into our most formidable adversary. And so woke capital claims to care about social justice and the like, but is most addicted to a relationship with the regime which runs gulags, Uyghur gulags, which has crushed Hong Kongers, which has no rule of law, no private property rights, no respect for the most basic fundamental liberties. And it shows that its so-called adherence to social justice is an absolute fraud. And essentially, our largest corporations try to buy absolution for their capitalist sins here, while at the same time, of course, doing business with the world's most regressive regime. And the last point that I'll very briefly make on this is that Gina Raimondo, the Commerce Secretary, has in multiple interviews recently said it's imperative that America increase economic engagement with communist China to kind of cool temperatures, cool the heads on both sides. That is absolute insanity. It is insanity defined. That is exactly what communist China has used to become our most formidable adversary over the last several decades. Doing the same thing over and over again is not only insane, but it's suicidal ultimately.
And Ben, you know, you mentioned individual companies and folks who run them, but you also have had interest groups like the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable weighing in, insisting that we need to get rid of these tariffs, we need to get back to engagement. And I must say, somewhat heartened that the trade representative yesterday, Kathleen Tsai, did not go there. But it does seem as though the administration is opening the door to greater expansion of waivers that would enable some of this business to go forward. They've also permitted, notably, Huawei to get back into business with some of our chip manufacturers. And I have a feeling that's the leading edge of a bigger effort in this regard. So where would this lead us if we wound up once again throwing in with China, relying even more heavily, perhaps, as your gal Ilhan Omar, representative from Minnesota, would have us do with Chinese supplies of lithium and batteries and the like for the Green New Deal? This would seem to me to be a formula for disaster, really, for our country. Do you see it that way as well?
Absolutely. I mean, it defies all logic to pursue a policy of making yourself essentially in the most strategically significant areas, right down to the generic medicines that we would use, to make your country reliant on its greatest adversary in the most fundamental areas, whether, again, that's pharmaceuticals, whether that's weapons manufacturing to fight wars. A whole slew of areas, obviously fifth generation telecommunications infrastructure and well beyond. Would China ever do such a thing? Would it make itself reliant on America? Of course not. And in fact, interestingly, the China hawks in America, we talk about decoupling from communist China. Communist China is talking about decoupling from us. They want to have onshore all of the capabilities that they need to shut off the spigots to anything and everything that we might wish to use. So when China talks about, they decry Americans for talking about decoupling, well, at home, they're talking about a conscious policy of decoupling ultimately themselves. And I think you make a great point that there's the appearance, at least, of an incoherence of the Biden administration with respect to this. Because on the one hand, you have the Commerce Secretary saying we need to increase engagement. And to your point, the Chamber of Commerce and a variety of other leading industry lobbies have come out pressing the administration to reopen up engagement and, of course, try to get over the tariffs as soon as possible. On the other hand, as you said, you have the U.S. Trade Representative saying we're not going to immediately pull off those tariffs. But all of that said, I think what it creates, and as you noted also, they have re-upped this sort of waivers program to allow companies to get around certain tariffs. So I think it creates the appearance of strategic incoherence, but I think in reality, it is a political decision, which is, of course, you have the representative of business advocating for business in the U.S. federal government, and you have a trade rep who appears to be hard-nosed. But over the long run, this coherence basically indicates that we don't have a consistent policy of seeking to decouple as best as we can. We don't see a conscious effort of the administration to say China needs to be out of our capital markets, period, full stop. It does appear that the clock is ticking on delisting Chinese companies, but I fear that the administration knows how politically bad it will look to go right back to the relationship we had with communist China. So they create the appearance of seeking to be tough on the one hand, on trade at least, while on the other hand, talking about opening up engagement. And I think they are trying to lull the American people to sleep on this, ultimately. That's my assessment of the situation. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they prove to be tough. I hope they keep the tariffs in place. I hope they increase the tariffs. But ultimately, I don't think it will play out that way.
Yeah. And to the extent you're right that there's a clock ticking on delisting Chinese companies in our capital markets, I'm afraid that the clock is very slow. There will be maybe 3 years, and a lot of things have to sort of align in order for that to happen, which is ridiculous, it seems to me, especially since, as you said, and Captain Jim Fennell did earlier in the program, Ben, we're talking about that money going directly into the coffers of the Chinese Communist Party and its People's Liberation Army in many cases. And this is, as you put it, greed-induced insanity in your Newsweek piece back in August, which I really commend to our audience. Let me turn to another agenda of Ilhan Omar. And again, your book about American Ingrate was such a powerful indictment of this woman and her agenda. You follow very closely international affairs in the Middle East, Ben Weingarten. Talk to us about what Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and others on the progressive or radical Marxist left were able to do, at least briefly, with respect to American support for the replenishment of the component parts, the ammunition, what have you, of the Iron Dome anti-rocket defense system of Israel, right in the midst, initially at least, of some incomings from Hamas, against which this thing has proven to be absolutely necessary and highly effective.
Well, I think you could make a case that, in effect, they provided material support to terrorists at its highest level. And let's be very clear, and your audience is well aware of this, but Iron Dome serves numerous strategic purposes for the benefit of American national interest. Leave aside the fact, of course, that Israel is our closest ally in the region. There are historical ties. There are legal ties. There are, of course, ties of morals and values and interests beyond that. And not the least of which, of course, is Israel is standing on the front line of a war with jihadists, a global war that jihadists wage against the West. And that is the front line defense of the Western civilization from jihadists. And of course, all the intelligence that Israel provides, the burgeoning partnership that Israel has with a slew of Sunni Arab nations, which of course redounds to America's interest in combating Iran. Set all that aside, Iron Dome also serves American national interest directly because it is essentially a technology sharing program. These are weapon systems that America uses, that America can sell to other allies and partners as well. So Iron Dome is squarely within America's national interest, as opposed to the billions of dollars that we throw at all manner of regressive regimes that ultimately serve no purpose for America. So, of course, it defines and it illustrates the Jew hatred of the regressive left, targeting Israel above all other countries. On its face, it's an absurdity. I think, of course, at a practical level, this would have potentially imperiled the lives of really the entire Jewish state, period, full stop. And what I tried to argue in that book, American Ingrate, was that the cave of Democratic leadership to, namely, Ilhan Omar, with respect to her clearly anti-Semitic comments, and even more importantly, perhaps, the regressive agenda that she supports, her links, ties, and coordination with all manner of Islamists, anti-American Islamists, foreign and domestic, showed that this is where the party was going. This is where the power, the energy in the party was. And look, the fact that we're talking about a comptroller of a currency who is almost literally a card-carrying communist, I think tells you all you need to know about the fact that this is where the left was going and this is where the left is. And so I hope my book proved prescient. If anything, it's sort of ahead of schedule, even the extent to which the party has become hostage to its so-called progressive left wing and anti-American wing, not just anti-Israeli, but anti-American and anti-Western wing of its party.
It certainly was prescient. And as your writing often is, Ben, you're looking over the horizon and I think seeing the sorts of things that are headed our way and warning about them. And shame on us that we're not taking them more to heart oftentimes and trying what we can do to stave them off. Speaking of which, let me just ask you about another terrorism angle that I know you're following. The Department of Justice has apparently now denounced people who are opposing this so-called critical race theory. I call it communist racist training, another CRT acronym. But what is the Department of Justice saying at this point, Ben, and what are the implications of it for, the instruction, the indoctrination, the brainwashing of our kids, of our military, of our government employees and others in this, as you say, anti-American doctrine?
The DOJ has been lobbied by at least one education group to try to cast those who are challenging the CRT orthodoxy that many, including, of course, the largest teachers union in the country, support imposing in public schools across the country. I call CRT racial Marxism. That's how I would sort of define it. And this education group has lobbied the DOJ, claiming that there were threats to the safety of teachers as a consequence of the backlash against CRT. And now the DOJ has responded. The Attorney General Merrick Garland put out a letter saying, in recent months, there's been a disturbing spike in harassment, intimidation, and threats of violence against school administrators, board members, teachers, and staff who participate in the vital work of running our nation's public schools. And these threats, of course, never cited, no specifics, no documentation on it, apparently are now going to occupy the time of the DOJ. The DOJ is going to seek to prosecute people. And this education group was seeking to classify critics as domestic terrorists, protesters against critical race theory. And I see this as part of a much broader rubric of areas where those who disagree with the official narrative on any number of issues that are critical to the ruling class seeking to impose its regime on us are now being cast as potential threats. It's either under public safety or public health. And I've been writing about this really since the week after January 6th, that there would be a domestic war on wrongthink undertaken, again, under the guise of public health and public safety. So we have seen the federal government, and this is through Homeland Security and others, try to cast those who question COVID-19 Chinese coronavirus policies as potential domestic threats, those who question the integrity of the 2020 election and perhaps beyond as domestic threats. And now we see it in terms of questioning dissenting from the orthodoxy on critical race theory. This is a hugely disturbing Rubicon that we are fast crossing. And you could see the makings of it in Russiagate and the attempt to use the national security and intelligence apparatus, sick it on President Trump and those around him as well. But now it's extended to millions of followers as well.
We appreciate very much, Ben, your time as well as your great work at Newsweek and elsewhere. Come back to us again soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until
you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.